Welcome to episode 127 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me on the podcast is Joe Ide, whose IQ just won the McCavity Award for Best Debut Novel at this year's BoucherCon, which just concluded in Toronto. Today, October 17th, is Pub Day for Righteous, the second in Joe's series about consulting detective Isaiah Quintabi. Here's Joe Ide.
Congratulations, by the way, on Righteous and the nomination for the Edgar and all of that. I mean, it's well-deserved and probably going to be repeated.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciated your encouragement. It means a lot to me. I mean, coming from a pro, you know, like you, it is meaningful to me.
We should qualify that by saying someone who's written, not the other kind of pro.
Yes, we will make that distinction. We will. It's nice to talk to you again.
It's nice to talk to you too. I enjoy my visit with Isaiah so much that I was all over your publicist to talk to you, a duck on a June bug. So,
okay, all right.
In IQ, your first book and the book that introduced us to Isaiah Quintabi, we learned that he was intelligent. In Righteous, your new book out on October 17th, Isaiah gets wise. Is that a fair assessment?
I think he's getting the beginnings of wise. He's just starting to realize that he's lonely, and he's pretty isolated. He wants a girlfriend. He wants to reach out to people, and so he is more self-aware. And it's something that I intend to carry on from book to book.
And also, I thought Isaiah's friend Dodson, who is the Watson to his Holmes, to Isaiah's Holmes, although in a very different kind of way, has also accumulated some wisdom of which readers in the previous book might not have thought him capable.
Yeah, I definitely didn't want to leave him or make him as continue that sort of wise guy hustler thing by itself, that I wanted to treat him like an important character, like he was the main character, and to give him an emotional life and give him room to grow and to give him his own relationships. Now that's really the interesting part for me to write, is the emotional life of the characters. A detective story, that part's actually relatively easy. It's thinking about the characters and what's going on with them, and by knowing that, what are they going to do? What are they going to say?
Well, what are they going to do? What are they going to say? How are they going to act? And more importantly, especially for Righteous, was how are they going to react?
Yes.
And I thought that how each one reacted to the two, you have two separate investigations going on. One of them is an official investigation, and the other is the unofficial, the one that that Isaiah is pursuing on his own. And that's the one I sort of want to talk about first, because at the end of your first book, Isaiah stumbles on what's left of the car that ran over and killed his brother Marcus. And
yes,
without introducing any spoilers, I think he finds out more than he wants to in this investigation. And that's sort of like you talk about him being isolated and maybe a little bit on the spectrum. But he learned a little, I thought, about ambiguity and more about the consequences of actions, and maybe even a little bit about guilt. that Isaiah didn't realize Marcus might have had, like guilty conscience, not criminal guilt necessarily. Yes. So is that
also? I think your analysis is better than one I could have given. That was really good. I do want him always to grow, always to learn things, and to become. I don't want to write the same guy every book. No, it's not interesting for me. I want him to have new experiences and learn from those experiences. For me, when I read a book, that's really important to me. You know, I want the character to change. I don't want to read about the guy for, you know, the same guy for 350 pages. It's not real interesting to write that way for me.
And I'm
anxious to see what ensues, because I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I write him into situations, and then because I know him, I see what he does. Oh, and then what that experience does to him. I'm really more focused on the character and life than I am anything else.
So that makes that leads me to believe that two things: that you are more of a seat of the pants writer, that you don't outline everything. And that brings me to mind I heard James Ellroy speak once, and he talked about 400-page outlines. And I had to sort of say to myself, not just me, I was actually at Dennis Lehane was speaking. He was being interviewed by Attica Locke, and it was fascinating. But everybody sort of, the writers in the audience all sort of looked at each other and went, well, 400-page outline, you know, that's the book.
Wow. Yeah, I start with one page of handwritten beat notes. and then I start writing. I have to see details. Everything reads differently on the page. And so I'll write the first page in great detail, and that informs page two. And as I'm going from page to page, the possibilities for what's ahead are occurring to me. Subplots are occurring to me. The subplots in pages, I didn't know what they were until I wrote them. It's a very organic process, and something that I think I got from Elmore Leonard. I mean, he said that he just lets the characters go, and he sees where they go. And if you set the characters up, then they'll do interesting things. And I'm much more of that school. I couldn't write an outline. it's just not the way I write. It's a chaotic process if you don't know where you're going. I backtrack a lot. I have to throw out a lot of pages. You know, in both IQ and Righteous, I threw out as many pages as I wrote. But that's just the way I write now. And, you know, I'm not going to change that anytime soon.
So you sort of embrace the chaos, get your arms around it, and then do your best to let Isaiah tell you where he wants to go in this universe that you're trying to hold together.
Yes, that's exactly it. And if he doesn't go someplace interesting, it means I haven't set it up right. I haven't given him enough motivation, or I haven't given him enough obstacles. And that's why I'm just always write way more than shows up in the book.
I was really struck in this book. I thought your depictions of the greater L.A. area were so spot on. And this is from Isaiah's home ground of East Long Beach, which is sort of this mysterious neighborhood that hardly anybody ever goes to. That doesn't live there. To the sort of the stainless steel and glass antisepticness of Century City. And, you know, The other thing I really appreciated was Dodson, when the book opens, is working on a trendy food truck, of which our city is famous for now. And before he rejoins Isaiah, and I thought maybe that was a bit of a dig at the trope of food truck cuisine hipness, or was I reading too much into that?
No, I try to find satirical material and little sneaky social commentary stuff as I go along. If I write I wrote the food truck, and these are funny kinds of things. And so wherever I go, I try and find something funny and satirical. And the city things. Descriptions of the parts of the city, I'm going more for, as you pointed out, really an emotional response. No, I'm not looking for accuracy. I want the reader to feel what it's like to be there. And if I get the details wrong, that's okay with me.
Well, I thought that the points you made about Century City, about sort of like After Five being completely devoid of humans, which it is. It's a city that only exists from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. You know, and then the rest of the time it's, you know, tumbleweeds.
That's true. It's very true. I don't like to go down there.
It's
a very weird place.
It's soul sucking. It's, you know, people who work there, you know, they work there, but nobody wants to go there voluntarily, except maybe to go shopping, you know, because a new mall just opened up. But even that is sort of like, meh.
Yeah, it's true. The housing there is weird too.
It's very it's very prefab. It's like really high-end prefab.
Yeah, and you can't see it. I mean, there's this huge wall that goes around, and it's a really dividing line between the haves and the have-nots. It really sends you the message. It really sends the message that you don't belong here.
And Isaiah feels that. I mean, when he encounters, he goes to meet, and we'll talk about now his paying case. Because that's locating and protecting the half-sister of his brother's former fiance, whom he has a pretty big crush on. And this girl happens to be an inveterate gambler, and that takes him to Las Vegas, which is, you know, it's difficult to talk about Las Vegas right now, but...
Yeah, it is, but yes.
It's almost like, you know, an extension of Los Angeles. I don't think a lot of people realize how much traffic there is between the two cities. They're really linked.
Very much so.
And
to try to get to Las Vegas on a weekend is really, it's like the 405 in the middle of the day.
It's the other 405.
It's true. It's true.
But it got me, this description of the drive between the two cities and the fact that the cases are linked got me to thinking about two things. That inveterate gamblers often get in trouble with gangs, which is, you know, organized crime or nothing but gangs. And that gangs often have outposts. So there are cooperative, let's say, agreements between gangs in both cities.
Oh, yes.
But there's also conflict between gangs in these two cities. And the story sort of gets into the nitty-gritty of those two. And so you said that you put him into situations. But I would think you had to research that. I would think that you may have changed the names of the gangs, but you had to research some of the gangs for this.
Everything right. Is part of what I already know, or remembrance, research, and stuff I make up. And I can't tell myself afterwards where one starts and the other leaves off. I'm trying to, one, be credible, but not pinpoint accurate. And it's always about the emotionality of it and what's happening with the characters. You know, I really focus on them and what they're going through during an event, during a shootout, during a chase. I'm interested in what's going through their heads. Otherwise, it's just a car chase. You know, it's hard to care about a car chase if you don't care about who's in the car. So that's my focus. And the gang thing, I did a lot of reading. But if I hadn't found what I wanted, I would have made it up. In most cases, I do find what I want, but you know, I have different priorities than accuracy. You know, unlike say Richard Price, who's always just spot on. You know, everything that happens in his books is absolutely authentic. I could never do that, and I don't want to. it's just my approach, I think.
I think the accuracy is important in that it helps readers suspend disbelief, but I didn't find anything that the characters did or any way that the gangs reacted or even the law enforcement individuals that showed up stopped me and made me go, oh no, that wouldn't happen. And because I think that fate often, you have one character who is the boyfriend of the half-sister who's just like a total, he's a committed gambler. He is, you know, he cannot function unless he's gambling to the point where he puts himself and anyone who's around him at, you know, risk. And he talks his girlfriend into risky behavior that gets her in trouble with her father, who happens to be the leader of a gang, she realizes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, but at the, you know, at the same time, you've got this kind of crazy, like, oh my God, this couldn't possibly happen. But it could. I mean, once again, this sort of, like you said, you put your characters in, you get the half-sister in to steal these passwords so she can get some money. And that's something I think that kids of criminals might do.
Yes, I mean, I think if the characters are emotionally true, that helps a lot with credibility. You know, if you believe in that character and that character's actions seem reasonable from their standpoint, that really helps with the credibility. Even when I'm writing something that's totally on the edge, that's just at that line where it just might be it might be incredible. If I stay inside the character and am honest about that and don't do it for convenience, that really helps. You know, that really helps. Because there's over the top stuff or near over the top stuff in both my books. But everybody's acting out of motives that you can understand. And that carries me a long way in terms of being credible.
Just as an aside, I think our idea of what's credible and what isn't has now been taken to levels we never thought they would be. So, you know, what these characters get up to it's just sort of, you know, I think life has gone way beyond art as far as, you know, deeds that are incomprehensible. I think everything in Righteous was understandable. Dodson is acting in order to get home to did he get married or is it still his girlfriend who's about to deliver?
He's about to get married. He gets married in book three.
Oh, well, hold that thought. You know, Dodson wants to get back to the mother of his child, who he's going to marry, who's, you know, at the just about to deliver. And Meanwhile, Isaiah's got two different things going on. He's got this paying gig to help this young woman not get killed by her father's gang, and try to track down Marcus's killers. And both cases end up in ways that he doesn't really expect. And that makes me want to ask about ambiguity, because Isaiah's got a very strong sense of right and wrong, and mm-hmm. yet he's got an ambiguous relationship with the gangs. And I personally think that that's a practicality in any investigator's work, whether it's a private detective like Isaiah or even a sworn officer of the law. And
he could not do if he stuck strictly to an ethical code, what others might think is an ethical code. He's pragmatic to a large degree. As long as the end result, if the objective is good, he will do things that are not kosher. But he's all about the result case, and so if he has to have these ambiguous relationships, that's fine. It causes a certain amount of ambiguity in him, and makes him doubt himself. But you know, those kinds of things are the same kinds of things that everybody goes through. Maybe not about the same things, but we are all ambiguous, all of them. And I think that if I want him to be real, if I want him to feel real, I have to give him the same kinds of dilemmas that we all go through. And those, I think, are the things that people identify with. You know, he has the same dilemma as me, as the people I know. And so while I want to make him larger than life, I also want to make him relatable.
Well, I think there's been an evolution in crime fiction, you know, from there's always been ambiguity. But some of the books at certain points, and then certainly some of the television shows like Dragnet, you know, that right was right and wrong mm-hmm. was wrong and never the twain shall meet. And
right.
But always, you know, Raymond Chandler's characters, and I think we talked about this last time, there was always a lot of ambiguity in Chandler's characters and mm-hmm. you know, kind of deals with the devil. And Isaiah, yeah. I think Isaiah's the one thing he won't countenance is any kind of violence against children. So he will rescue a family member of a gang if he feels when the previous book when she was kidnapped, but then mm-hmm. he'll trade it for information. Later on, he's really, really smart that way. It's other ways, yeah, you know, especially with women, that he's maybe not as smart.
Yeah, I can relate to that too. he is, I mean, there are many times in the book when he is me, when he reflects my experiences. And I don't think my experiences are that unusual. In terms of getting through life and having relationships with people. And so I have a lot of material, you know, I have a lot of material about those aspects, and I can use him. You know, I have a place to put those feelings and those ambiguities. And it's great that way. It really is. I really like writing him. And he is different from me in many ways, but, many of those kinds of things were my dilemmas too.
I think Los Angeles can always use. Los Angeles is a big city. It's different than any other big city. It's probably got more contrast than anywhere else, and that includes New York, New York City. Mm-hmm. It's and Isaiah is a perfect poster child, although he's not a child, but you know what I mean. He's a perfect example of this, that, you know, you at any given time you're going to run into Armenian gangs, Chinese gangs, Mexican-American gangs, El Salvadorian gangs, which are different than Mexican gangs, very different. And, you know, other Asian gangs, Vietnamese, and then, you know, the law enforcement, because they're just their own gangs, they're their own organizations, and they also have differentiation because you've got Los Angeles PD and sheriff and Long Beach. It's really a mosaic, and I think he does a great job of showing us that mosaic as he navigates it. So
thank you. It's LA is a great canvas. Yeah, as you say, there are so many different parts and different cultures that I can pretty much do anything in LA. You know, there's an environment that I want that isn't here for the most part. And so it's great to have, you know, it's great to have the city be part of the book and to, they say, you know, the city is a character in the book. I like that idea. I like that idea. And I like going to someplace like Century City or East Long Beach and trying to get the feel of it and then to write that feeling. It's far more interesting to me than a physical description.
So now that Isaiah's internal compass has been realigned, with some significant reality checks towards women and his life and all his preconceived notions have all been sort of recalibrated. You hinted at it. So what's next for him and Dodson?
Their relationship will change. They will try to be partners. Which is going to be difficult. I mean, they are very different and usually have different agendas. And so they will enter into a true partnership and it will be rough going. You know, they'll help each other and they won't. And there's Grace, the woman that he meets. And she will reappear. And it's going to be his first entry into a relationship. And let's see what else.
I like Grace. I like a woman that goes to a junkyard to find parts for her car. That's my kind of person.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't match up Isaiah with someone who would be an ordinary woman in some other book. He needs to have someone that is challenging, and that relationship will be challenging. You know, they're both shy, they're both secretive, they're not all that great at relationships. And you know, I didn't know where that relationship was going to go when I ended Righteous, but I set the characters up that way just to generate a lot of conflict. Just to make it hard for them. She has a backstory that makes it really hard for her. And I didn't know where that was going to go. But it's been really interesting to write and find out, you know, where the relationship goes.
No, I could tell she had a story. I could tell she had a story when she shows up at the beginning of the book. And then when she shows up again at the end, I thought, oh, yeah, this chick is definitely got an interesting story. She has to.
Yes. Well, yes. And hopefully she does. She was fun to write. And I haven't written a woman that's a major character. And so that was really interesting. It's sort of like Michael Connelly. His new book, he has a new female character, a new female police officer. And I forget her name, but
Renee Ballard, I believe, is her name.
There you go. He just wrote her like anybody else. there's nothing particularly, you know, cliche female kind of point of view. He wrote her like anybody else, as a person. And I tried to write her, I tried to write Grace like a person. And that was interesting, and it was fun. So there's those, and Dodson has to deal with his new situation. You know, he's a father now. He has to deal with fatherhood, and, you know, he's a hustler's hustler, so it's, you know, it's not a comfortable thing for him to be doing. His relationship with Charisse is changing. The story itself, there are new bad guys. There are new bad guys and, you know, new big stories. And, I can tell you that the bad guys are a group of CIA agents and guards who were at Abu Ghraib.
Ah.
That's their background. So they were really fun to write. And those kinds of things give me an opportunity, you know, to take, to comment on what happened there. No, it's a thing you have to be careful about. You know, you're not writing a screed.
Right.
I look for those opportunities, you know, to add something that has some gravity to it. So that's what's coming.
Well, it's something we look forward to, and it's interesting that you mentioned Michael Connelly and his new character and writing women as people, and I think that that's something that's become more and more important to me. Not that this podcast is about me, but that that all writers and we should mention, if people don't know, that you are Japanese American, and you know that you're not identified as a Japanese American crime fiction writer. You are a crime fiction writer. Women should not be identified as women crime fiction writers, and the characters, there shouldn't be a differentiation in whether the character like Isaiah is a young man of color, or of Asian descent, or a man, or a woman, or they are all characters, and they all have to live in your universe. And I hope, at least in our community, that we're of crime fiction writers and fans, that we're moving in that direction of unification as opposed to fracturing. And I think when you bring in something like what happened at Abu Ghraib, that's something that other writers are doing. T. Jefferson Parker's Room of White Fire had a plot that involved some of the things that had happened in our never-ending wars in the Middle East. And, there's an impact. Although we're all sort of unifying, these things are in our universe, and they impact artists. You know, you have to deal with them.
I think when you add that kind of material, you're giving weight to your story, and you're giving, you're raising the stakes. You're putting it on a bigger stage, and what the character has vested becomes more important. So I continue to try and do that, and hopefully it works out.
Well, I'm now, of course, going to start counting off the days for the next book. Does it have a name, or is that still up? That is still a secret.
That's still a secret. We don't know. Well, it's not a secret. We don't know.
it will come to you much like the rest of your stories. Joey Day, thank you so much. I know you're busy. Your book's about to launch, and I think you're going to BoucherCon, aren't you?
I am.
Joey Day, thank you again for your time, and congratulations on Righteous, and I look forward to seeing you when you get back from Toronto, hopefully at a signing. Thank you again.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure.